How's it going, guys? Welcome to the latest episode of the A10 Talk podcast. I'm your host, as usual, Sam Basil. Joined alongside me today are Daniel Frank and Edward Major, two great contributors to A10 Talk, both on the written side and photography side. And we're going to be, you know, talking about every single team in the A10 leading into this 2021-2022 season. And so this week, we're going to be talking a little Fordham, a little George Mason, like we did last week. But then we're also going to be talking about the George Washington Colonials and the Duquesne Dukes. How are you guys doing tonight?
Can't complain. Doing pretty good. Excited to get this season almost underway here. We're, three weeks out? A little over 3 weeks?
And then, Danny, you know, you're kind of a unique contributor to A10 Talk and how you talk about you're a fan of both Mason and GW. So, I mean, how excited are you to get involved in this episode tonight?
I am so thrilled to be here tonight. Love always coming on the podcast. Just looking forward to a really great season, hopefully. I mean, we'll talk about expectations and all that stuff tonight. But, you know, I'm just looking forward to, I believe this is going to be my 7th year at A10 Talk. I've been started off doing GW, picked up Mason along the way when I, you know, applied as a student. Now I'm a senior at Mason, and hey, I just passed midterm, so I'm feeling okay tonight.
All right, and before we get to GW and Mason and Duquesne, let's start off with the Fordham Rams. So the biggest story surrounding Fordham going into this season is obviously, as we've talked about on this podcast, the introduction of Kyle Neptune as the head coach. And I think the general consensus around a lot of people who follow Fordham basketball is that Fordham is already stepping in the right direction. I mean, people are already pretty happy. But going into this season, what's a realistic goal for Fordham in 2022? Is it a winning record in conference play? Is it just, you know, making it through the season like they were, you know, they struggled with last year? Or is it, you know, actually being a contender in this conference? Starting off with you, Daniel.
You know, I think anyone in the Bronx would just be happy. And again, I don't want to speak for anyone, but I think they would just be happy with finishing not 14th. And I don't say that in a sarcastic way. I don't say it in jest. I think just any sign of movement in the right direction for Fordham, I think, is really important. I think I know there's a lot of talk about how expectations should be for a coach in their first year. I know there's certainly been that discussion to George Mason. But I think for Fordham, I think just you want to see some kind of positive step in that right direction. I think that's absolutely crucial for them. So look, I think if I were a Fordham fan, I'd be ecstatic with like 11th, 12th place finish. Just step in the right direction.
And, you know, Edward, what would you say is a result that would leave Fordham fans happy at the end of this season?
I mean, I'd really say they don't really have too high of a bar to meet. They finished with two conference wins last season, what went 2-11. And I kind of see them a whole lot like they're very similar to Duquesne a few years ago during Keith Dambrot's first year. You know, the expectations weren't super high. It was just like, okay, I'm excited for this now. Let's see if he can do something with this team. So I'd say anywhere in the 5, 6, maybe 7 win area, it would meet the expectations for most of those Fordham fans. After the last few years they've had, just a change of scenery, a new coach will probably definitely help out. And that's at least the expectation for this year. We can talk more in future years about getting up there beyond that. But right now, I think the expectations remain fairly low, but still optimistic for at least better than they have been.
Yeah, I mean, I think you guys hit the nail right on the head. I, in my A10 Talk season preview, I think I mentioned this last week, I have them going 6-12 in conference play. And when I was making that record, I kind of broke down games by games that they need to win with teams like George Washington, Mason, St. Joe's, not necessarily games that they will win, but I think games that, you know, if they want to make people happy and, you know, be happy with themselves, they should win. Teams that they could steal a win from, shake things up in the conference, schools like Dayton, maybe even LaSalle or UMass. I think they were competitive against UMass last year. And then games that are at this point a wash, like St. Bonaventure and St. Louis. And so moving on, we'll be talking about a lot about Fordham later on this season. Moving on with George Mason, who also bring in a new head coach this year. You know, we talked about Kim English a lot last week. But let's talk about the actual players on George Mason. Daniel, who would you say is, you know, kind of the standout on George Mason's roster this year? Who is their leader?
You know, it's interesting. I got to go to the open practice that they had probably about a month ago or so back. And there was definitely some interesting names that stood out to me. I think Josh Arduro is the obvious. He was, as I mentioned last time, the big fish that Kim Engost really wanted to keep at Mason, and he was successful in doing so. But from just eyewitness and kind of expectation, things like that, I've put together a starting five that I think has the length and the athleticism that could really put Mason in a good position. So here's what I've got written down here. I've got Josh Arduro. I've got Jamal, and this is not necessarily by order of position. This is just five guys that I've put. Josh Arduro, Jamal Hartwell II, Deshaun Schwartz, Malik Henry, and Devon Cooper. They all look like pieces on this roster. Like I've said it before, Josh Arduro, if he really reaches his full potential, he could win Atlantic 10 MVP. I'm not saying he will, but I think he has that ability. From a Jamal Hartwell perspective, he's got the ability to drop 25 on any night if he's hitting his threes, which he has seemingly an eternal green light to do so. Deshaun Schwartz is a transfer from Colorado, and he's just a dude. I mean, we talk a lot in basketball having, you know, there's a lot of guys on this roster, whatever. He's a dude. He's just a flat out baller, and he's just going to be a lot of fun to watch. And Mason's just not had a lot of dudes on the roster. Malik Henry to me looks like peak AJ Wilson in terms of the explosivity he has and his game above the rim. I mean, I know that Mason fans like to joke about the unfortunate comment that Dave Paulson made, saying that, you know, Malik Henry is going to make us all forget about AJ Wilson, then made this comment, of course, while AJ Wilson was still on the team. And we say that in jest, but I think there may be a degree of truth to that this year, especially given how AJ did in his last year at Mason. And then the fifth piece to that lineup is Devon Cooper. He's the transfer from Morehead State. He's a really big piece of why they got to the NCAA tournament a year ago. He's kind of fallen off the radar a little bit just in terms of the other dudes on the roster. You know, he doesn't have the same big name school recognition that some of the other transfers new to the roster have, but I think he's going to be a really, really critical piece to this roster this year.
And so talking about Josh Arduro, I mean, you gave a lot of names. I mean, 8-9 names for a team that going into this season, a lot of people were saying is just going to be the Josh Arduro show. So do you think this team has what it takes to, you know, not overwork Arduro in the paint and let their stars excel without providing enough help on the court so that they're not exhausted by the end of a game, or they can't make it through an A-10 tourney run because they're just getting so many minutes that they're just exhausted?
Right. I think that's absolutely a great point. I mean, there's, especially with the position Mason's been in the past, they've obviously never gotten top four seed in the A-10 tournament. So you're always looking at having that one extra game under your belt. And I know that was just the case a couple years ago when they had the A-10 tournament in DC, and I believe 2018, Mason had a little bit of momentum going, but you could tell by the time they got into that quarterfinal round, they just ran out of gas. I mean, and we talk a lot about workload management with guys and managing minutes. And obviously you're always trying to manage the egos of guys and making sure everyone feels like they're getting the playing time they deserve, while also, you know, obviously want to have your best five guys on the court at any given time that you can. But I think having guys like, you know, Devontae Ticket Gaines, who's a transfer from Tennessee, just as a casual guy, you can bring it off the bench. I mean, in years past, who was the guy, like last year when Josh Arduro went out of the game with foul trouble or whatever, no disrespect to, you know, Greg Calixt, but you lost a bit of talent and athleticism when Josh Arduro left the court. You know, and that's something that you knew you could count on. And, you know, when you had Malik Henry go in there, he was a freshman. I mean, what was he supposed to do? I mean, now you've got some guys that give you some roster flexibility that Mason just frankly has not had in recent memory. I mean, they've got, and obviously all this is dependent on them staying healthy. And that's always, you know, been the big question for Mason as well, going back the last several years. But boy, it's hard not to be optimistic about just the piece they have on this roster. I mean, it's, I don't want to overestimate them or oversell them, but it's exciting. I got to say.
Yeah, and I don't think you're overselling them at all. I mean, here at A-10 Talk, we try to, you know, be good journalists and be fair, but at the same time, we're also fans. We want this conference to succeed. And so I don't see you selling this team you know, higher than their abilities. But Edward, you know, a question I have for you that, you know, in Daniel's description of George Mason kind of caught my attention. Josh Oduro as a potential candidate for A-10 player of the year. This is something that gets talked about a lot in NBA circles, NFL circles, on, you know, what the criteria is for an MVP of a given league or a given sport. Is Mason's, you know, lack of potential to possibly win the A-10, would that bring down Josh Oduro's MVP potential? Or if he has a, you know, a stellar season on a team that only makes maybe the quarterfinals of the A-10 tournament, will that be enough for a guy like Oduro to really stand out?
I don't know. I mean, personally, I would be more inclined to, you know, if it was up to me, I'd be more inclined to pick a guy that had a fantastic season on a subpar team, just because that I feel that could just kind of shows the skill level of that individual player. And when you're talking about like MVPs and like individual accolades, you're not focused on, you shouldn't be focused on the whole team, the performance of the entire team, because it takes an entire team to win a game, to win a tournament, to win a championship. When you're talking about those individual accolades, you need to be looking at the specific skill of that player. And when a player can perform so highly despite the things going on around him, despite maybe subpar skill and effort of the players around him, I think that only proves the point more for that player to win that award, because he's kind of doing that in spite of things that are, I'll say, holding him back, for lack of a better term. Not to say that players hold back other players all the time, but you get my argument here.
Yeah, I totally get your argument there. I mean, you know, it's kind of one of those things where, you know, it's one of those arguments that may never end. Something we'll be arguing about in, you know, 2022, 2030, et cetera, et cetera. But another question I have for you, Edward, you know, about Mason, a lot of people were talking about with Kyle Neptune, you know, he's a New York guy. He's bringing in New York players. But Kim English, he's already got couple solid transfers, you know, in his first season at George Mason. What do you think about the arrival of new transfers like Deshaun Schwartz and Devontae Gaines? And do you think this shows that Kim English is already a solid recruiter?
I mean, anytime you can be branching out from that region where people expect you to be getting your recruits from, probably shows that you're a solid recruiter, because it's like, everyone expects you to pull from a certain area, but if you kind of start successfully pulling from your rivals' areas, especially with Mason and George Washington both down there, natural competitors in the recruiting game there anyway. So if you're kind of pulling the edge and pulling these players to your school as opposed to your rivals, you know, come from outside your typical area or from outside where others would expect you to be getting your recruits from, I'd say that shows good recruiting right there.
Yeah, and I mean, Mason is probably one of the best recruiting regions to pull from, the DMV. I mean, aside from New York and LA. So, I mean, if they can compete, first they got to compete with schools like George Washington. Obviously, you got to compete in your conference, and you can't let your conference opponents who you're going to be playing 2-3 times a year, you know, snag the guys that you want to get. But yeah, in a couple of years, if schools like GW or George Mason could even be competing with Georgetown, I mean, that'd be huge for that school. And so kind of moving on to, you know, the other team in the DMV area that's also in the A-10, George Washington. They finished, you know, 3-5 in conference play last year. They got, you know, killed. They were one of the couple schools in the A-10 alongside, you know, Fordham and Duquesne that just really got killed by COVID. And aside from losing games, you know, there was a lot of problems going on, I feel, within the program. I mean, we had players leaving before games. Daniel, how would you evaluate last season's George Washington team just from a morale standpoint?
Yeah, my morale as a GW fan is low, if I'm being honest. And that's incredibly frustrating because purely from a standings record standpoint, GW has made no signs of improvement under Jamie Christian compared to where the program was when he took over for Maurice Joseph. I mean, yes, last year was obviously an outlier because of COVID. You know, 3-5 record, you're never going to have, God willing. And now we're playing 18 conference games. God willing, we never have another year where GW plays 8 games, you know, conference games. But I mean, 9 were postponed due to COVID. They had 1 rescheduled, obviously, due to the Capitol insurrection, which, you know, God knows if that'll, you know, that was the UMass game. And that just never got put back on the schedule because there were, I think, like 70 odd games across the conference that never happened because of COVID. I tried to keep track of it all on a spreadsheet and it was a constant everyday thing to keep up with it. I mean, they went 5-12 overall. Their 5 wins were Coppin State, Duquesne, they beat Fordham twice, and they beat Rhode Island. And, you know, the roadie win was kind of weird because that was the one game that they had. I think it was the only game that they had all 3 of Jameson Battle, James Bishop, and Ricky Lindo Jr. And then Ricky got injured. I guess. So they never again had all 3 of them. And as it turns out, they never will again because Jameson Battle went and transferred. Jamie and Christian, just looking at his record, he's had 2 years at GW. He went 12-20 his first year, 6-12 in the conference. 5-12 last year, 3-5 in the conference. His total record at GW is 17-32, 9-17 in 2 seasons. GW still has not had a winning record since 2017, which was Maurice Joseph's first year. It was his interim year. It was the year he had 2 NBA players on the roster still, and Tyler Cavanaugh and Yuta Watanabe. They had a lot of the NIT championship team that, you know, pieces that came back for that one season. All basically Mojo had to do, and I say this as kindly as possible, was just not drive the bus off the cliff. But in the 4 years since that year, they are 41-74, 20-39. And as I just indicated with the numbers last 2 years, there's not been that upward trend yet. And it's GW fans are a relatively patient bunch, I'd like to believe. God knows we gave Jen Rosati enough years at GW with the women's basketball program. We gave her more than I would have. And I'm frustrated because I want so badly for GW to be relevant again. I mean, there has not been a point in my lifetime. I'm 22 years old. There has not been a point in my lifetime that GW was in the playing game for more than 1 year. And this is now a stretch of like going on 5 years. We're talking about GW being almost a shoe-in for the playing game. And yes, maybe call me a privileged GW fan because other schools would, you know, relate and they're stuck in this year after year, LaSalle's, whatever. I'm not trying to show shade at anyone. This is not the level that GW expects to be at for more than 1 year at a time. It'd be unacceptable for it to be for 1 year. And now we're going on 5 years of this. And look, I understand the circumstances, but like you mentioned, guys leaving in the middle of the year. Okay, maybe it happens where there's like, yeah, one guy leaves. But GW had like 3 last year. I mean,
it was 3 in a short period of time.
Right.
I think I was at the Fordham GW game. And I think 2 guys within 24 hours before that game announced that they were no longer going to be with the team.
I think it was Maceo Jack and Jameer Nelson Jr., if I remember correctly, who were not insignificant parts of the team. Like, it's not like they were some end of the benchers.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where, you know, college sports is one of those things where it's not like professional sports where if you don't like your situation, you can request a trade at the deadline. You know, you can't be like Ben Simmons and want to get out of Dodge. You just got to not play. So for these guys to choose not playing over being in that George Washington program, I mean, what does that say about that program at that time? What does that say about Jamie and Christian and his coaching abilities?
I mean, they lost 9 guys between the middle of last season and the off season. They lost, going in order. Now, Javier Longarica did not play last season. He opted out due to COVID. But aside from Javier, Ace Stallings, Chase Parr, Tyler Brelsford, Sloan Seymour, Jameer Nelson Jr., Maceo Jack, Jameson Battle, and Lincoln Ball. All of those guys were dudes that saw minutes. Now, partially guys like Lincoln Ball got into the games because of the fact that other guys transferred in the middle of the year. But we're not talking about some guys that never got in games, never had the chance to make an impact. I mean, these are guys that were starting some of them and left. Like, like, look, Jameson Battle leaving to go to Minnesota, it's hard to fault a guy from the Atlantic 10 wanting to go to a Power 5 school. I'm never going to fault someone for that appeal, especially in the NIL era. But guys leaving, Lincoln Ball went to American, Maceo Jack to Buffalo, Jameer Nelson to Delaware, Sloan Seymour to New Hampshire, Brelsford to Bryant, and Chase Parr to Towson. How in any world is that a better move to a higher level? That's not the types of moves they're making. I mean, it doesn't make sense from that regard, which means that there's something going on here that just I don't want to insinuate anything, obviously, and that's not at all what I intend to do, but there's some reason that these guys are choosing to downgrade to lower conferences when they're starting an Atlantic 10 level. And it's just something is just not, GW is not winning games. They're not keeping guys. I mean, it's just a bad situation all around.
No, I totally agree. I mean, you know, in the early press conferences for last season's, the tip off for the 2020-2021 season, it seemed like Jamie and Christian really wanted to, you know, work on a sense of camaraderie with his guys. That was his main focus. It was almost more of a focus than building a winning record, which may have been the problem. But Edward, you know, my question for you is, you know, if you're Jamie and Christian and you've got George Washington fans like Daniel ready to break down your door and, you know, replace you as head coach, is there anything you can do to save this program this year? Or are you just trying to ride it out, have a good time, get some wins, and, you know, build up a good reputation for the next school that's going to want to hire you?
Is there anything you can do to save the program this year? Make the semifinals of the A-10 tournament, maybe? That's probably about the only thing. At least make it semifinals, maybe win the whole thing. Beyond that, like Daniel was saying, just constantly losing guys, and even in the middle of a year, that's not something that anyone should expect or that any fan base would want to tolerate, than any athletic director should want to tolerate. So really, it's A-10 champions or bust. I'll say it. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, no, I mean, you bring up a good point. And, you know, talking about, you know, all the guys that have left that program in the midseason and the offseason, pretty much one of the only major players from, you know, the past couple of years has been James Bishop. Is James Bishop almost going to be taking on kind of like a player coach role? Is he going to be, you know, the guy that George Washington is going to be looking to? I mean, of course, you know, these are college kids. I mean, that's a big role to tack on to somebody. But say they have a Fordham situation where an assistant coach takes over halfway through conference play. How does James Bishop, you know, fit into this situation?
I mean, I think unquestionably he's going to have to. I mean, he is the, as bizarre it is to say about a team that finished in what, 11th place, or sorry, 12, whatever it was they were, I don't even remember. He was the leading scorer in the Atlantic 10 last year, like James Bishop was, which is bizarre to think about such a pitiful team that they were. And I don't mean that in a negative way, other than it just was pitiful to watch at times. I mean, they've got five new guys coming in. They got Brendan Adams from UConn, Joe Bamzil from Virginia Tech, Ira Lee from Arizona, Brian Knapp from Cornell, and Quanzi Samuels from Florida Gulf Coast. The most points per game average of any of those guys is Brian Knapp, who averaged 7 points a game at Cornell. Everyone else is sub five. It's always a crapshoot when you bring in guys that are transfers, because you obviously never know what the situation is at the previous school. Obviously, Brian Knapp didn't play last year because of COVID. Ivy League not play last year. So he's going to have had sat out regardless for one season. So you never know how that affects a kid. The rest of them, you want to think they all fit in the lineup well. You'd like to think that. I mean, God knows there's enough roster spots available right now. But I mean, I think unquestionably, this is James, going back to the original question, this is James Bishop team. I mean, he's going to have to average 25 points a game again if GW is going to at all be relevant. I mean, we put together, just to plug it real quick, for A-10 Talk, we put together power rankings usually every week during the season, and we posted our preseason ones. And, you know, attached to that, we had percentage chances to reach the NCAA tournament. There was one team on that list that was given a 0.0% chance. And no, and I mean this with no disrespect, Sam, it is not Fordham. I think if you'd asked most people who was 0.0 on the list of the 14 teams in the conference, I think most people jokingly or otherwise would say Fordham. It is not. It's GW. And that is something that does not sit well with me. And it cannot sit well with anybody in Foggy Bottom. It just, that is not the conversation GW should be in ever. And they have been that consistently for 5 years now going on.
What's sitting worse with you? The fact that they're lower than Fordham or the fact that their chance is 0.0?
Yes. No, if I'm going to give you a serious answer, probably that they're 0.0. Because, again, I want to give Fordham some credit, especially with their new coaching staff. I want to give them respect. You know, if obviously if they get to the point where they deserve it with some wins and yada, yada. I want to give Fordham credit. GW at a 0.0. Not a fan.
Yeah, rough times in the DMV. But moving on to, you know, the Pittsburgh area with Duquesne, let's kind of talk about, you know, a coach who might not necessarily be in the hot seat, but I think may not be entirely living up to the expectations that were set for him, you know, when he first walked in, and that's Keith Dambro. You know, in 4 years at Duquesne, he's posted a record of 65-47, but he's never been able to take the Dukes past the quarterfinals of the A-10 tournament. And so, Edward, my question for you is, you know, has Keith Dambro lived up to the expectations that fans and the administration had for him? Or has he been kind of a lukewarm coach?
I'll put it bluntly, no, he has not. Although it's kind of hard to really tell what the expectations were when he came in, because I mean, at that point, people were kind of sick of Jim Ferry. So, you know, people were kind of a lot like Fordham is kind of treating Kyle Neptune right now. It's that they're just happy to have somebody new, so just some kind of change in scenery. They're just glad for that. And the expectations, I think, were a little higher for Dambro in his first year than maybe Fordham will have for Neptune this year. And I mean, it looked promising. In 2018, I think when the A-10 tournament was in D.C., I went to that tournament. I covered that game, and they looked promising until they just kind of got drummed out by Richmond. And since then, they haven't done anything of note. And I feel like that's been the expectations, where Dambro has to do something of note in the A-10 tournament or otherwise, and he just hasn't. It's just as simple as that. So, I mean, he kind of turned a corner a little bit last season, despite all the COVID, despite kind of limping to a 500 record, both in conference play and overall. But they got drummed out by St. Bonaventure in the tournament. So it's really, I can talk about this a little later on as we go through this, but really within the next, if something doesn't happen here of note within the next 2 to 3 seasons, maybe not even 3 seasons, probably 1 to 2 seasons, Duquesne might have to start considering somebody else. I don't know. But something of note has to happen, whatever that is going to be.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty great opening assessment if I've ever heard one. Another question I have for you is, you know, you're talking a lot about how Keith Dambro has not really had that one big moment that kind of solidifies him as a good coach at Duquesne. But let's talk about, you know, something that was out of his control and out of the control of pretty much everyone in the sports world in March of 2020. Going into the A-10 tournament, he had posted a record. Duquesne had posted a conference play record of 11-7 in conference play, and they were 21-9 overall that season. And then obviously COVID happened and everything shut down. Do you think there was a lot left on the table with that 2019-2020 team that we just did not get to see?
Oh, for sure. That was a strong team, but it's kind of like how every sports team in the country is saying right now. They're looking at canceled tournaments, canceled games. They're looking at how strong they had been that season. And they're going, oh, that was going to be our year. That could have been our year. You know, and that it could have been. That could have been that thing of note that Duquesne could have done, that Dambro could have put together. But unfortunately, we'll never know. And yeah, last year, you can't say, oh, well, they wouldn't have done anything that year because last year they limped to a 500 finish. Last year was a whole nother ball game. So really, if you want to look at the preview of this season, you look at that season 2 years ago, you look at that canceled tournament and you go, what could they have done then? Could they do that now? And we can get to that in a little bit too, as we kind of, as we talk about the players and things they've lost, things they've gained. But like I said, going back to my last point, it's kind of, it's water under the bridge. The only thing that Danbrough needs to worry about now is he needs to do something with this roster, or he might have to be doing something with his resume.
Yeah, all good points. And Daniel, you know, looking at what he has, the resources that Danbrough has with this team, I mean, Duquesne, you know, they're another one of those teams alongside George Washington and Fordham, who I feel like never really got a chance to play at all last year. I mean, I read a weekly column for my other website just covering the A10 in general, and I would get excited, you know, thinking, oh my God, I have something to talk about with Duquesne. And every time they were there, I mean, they were a fun team to watch. But, you know, especially with guys like Tavian Dunn-Martin. But what about, you know, Duquesne maybe on the X's and O's side, or, you know, on the overall skill level side, has had them, you know, stuck in the middle of the table of this conference for the past couple of years?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question. I don't know. I think part of it might just be that Duquesne for the longest time just wasn't, you know, the very sexy school name that people were looking at of like, oh man, I want to go there. Like, you know, their facilities weren't, especially the couple years that they had to play at the community college or whatever, you know, while they were getting their arena renovated, you know, that's not something that a recruit's going to immediately jump at, especially in the transfer portal when they're looking at like next season or whatever. That's going to make them excited to come to a school or whatever. And one of the things I'm genuinely hoping for Duquesne's benefit to happen is we're finally going to get to see that beautiful new arena with fans this year. I mean, I know they had limited capacity at points last season, I believe, but we're finally going to get to see what that arena really can be like, because it, I mean, it looks beautiful. I remember the opening game, I believe, if memory serves, was actually on like ESPN, ESPN2 or something.
They were hosting Dayton.
Yes, yes, it was. And it looked beautiful on television. Ed, I think you were there that night, so you can tell me.
It was a nice arena to be in.
Absolutely. I mean, and more than just, you know, the playing surface and what you could see on camera, just knowing the, you know, what the concession area looks like in the weight room. And I know that the concession is something that sounds weird to say. But, you know, those are things that add up in the end of the day of what is the arena experience going to be like for these guys playing in this arena. They want it to be something they're proud of. They don't want it to be some dinky little high school gym that is the butt of the league. I mean, it's guys want to have something that they feel they can identify with. And I think that's something that Duquesne, that you indicated a little bit, to Ed, that they've lacked some sort of identity, I think, for a long period of time. And I think they're finally, with Danbrough, getting to that. They want to be this tough-nosed, hard team to play against. And I think they're getting to that point. I agree with you. I think they definitely need to take some steps forward sooner rather than later. Otherwise, they're going to continue, as you said, Sam, to just kind of be in this middling point of the conference. And I think that more so because of the new arena, the facilities, the athletic department has shown that they have put resources into this program. They're not going to be satisfied with a seventh place finish the way they might have been in the past. They're going to eventually want to get to the point that some of these other schools are attaining the success that they're like, hey, why is that not us? You know, we should be getting to that point. And I genuinely hope for Duquesne's and for the rest of the conference. I mean, having a team like Duquesne be really good would be so good for the conference. It would just elevate everyone else. And I really think that's important that they get there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I've really been able to see a lot of what the new arena actually looks like, you know, during a game. I've seen a lot of renderings and I've seen some photos and it looks great. I mean, it almost looks kind of futuristic in some ways with the new screen and everything. My question for you, Ed, is, you know, as a photographer, you know, a pretty good photographer, might I add, I was checking out your website before the podcast. How exciting is it, you know, to be able to attend these games with full fans?
I mean, that fans, and this is really just any sporting event for me that I cover. I cover a lot of hockey mostly, and I do a little bit of football here and there and some basketball. But like having fans in the building, it is just, it's a feeling. Like there's that rule. There's that rule. And I think we've all kind of, we've seen on social media over the last week or so that unspoken rule that they say about journalists, no cheering in the press box, that kind of thing. Like you're not supposed to show that emotion. You have to be like unbiased, impartial, but being surrounded by all the fans and seeing how excited everyone is, it gets you excited to cover whatever you're covering, that sport. And even with the limited fans that were there in the couple of games they played at the new facility last season, it got me excited to be there. I was happy to be there. I was happy to be back. And let me tell you, there's not a bad spot in that arena to be shooting from. They restricted us to the concourse. They wouldn't let us down onto the court, but there's not a bad spot in that arena at all. And just being able to kind of be around those fans, and it'll be a hell of a lot more fun, 10 times as fun with a packed crowd this season.
Of course. And, you know, Duquesne being located in Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh is probably one of the biggest markets in the United States in terms of sports without an NBA team. So with this new arena and some generated buzz, do you think Duquesne could get enough attention to become, you know, kind of the unofficial team of Pittsburgh? I mean, what do you think Duquesne's place in terms of Pittsburgh culture currently stands?
Well, your sports culture in Pittsburgh is always going to be your pro teams, at least your Steelers and your Penguins first. And you're always going to have Pitt football up there too. But you know, if your best bet is to fight for fourth place, that's not a bad place to be in the Pittsburgh sports scene. There's more than enough room for Duquesne basketball to even be the fourth most popular sport there and still be very, very high and popular there. And let's face it, you're competing with the other D1 basketball programs. They're Robert Morris and Pitt, and Robert Morris is not a very high bar to meet to compete with them. Pitt, well, they just keep lowering the bar for themselves. So they're not a very high bar to meet either. So you don't have to worry about either of those programs. So like I mentioned before, if Danbro can do something of note, if he can have some kind of success sooner rather than later, he's going to be one of the more popular sports in the Pittsburgh area.
Definitely. And, you know, finally, kind of our final portion of this segment tonight, going into these two teams, GW and Duquesne, let's talk about their non-conference schedules. For me, looking at Duquesne, I've always been impressed with some of the non-conference opponents Duquesne has been able to draw. I mean, that might be in recent years, might be in part due to Keith Danbro, you know, because a lot of these matchups are, you know, drawn between relationships between the coaches and the schools. What's the biggest non-conference game that you think Duquesne fans should be looking out for?
I mean, really, your biggest non-conference game I would say it's going to be that home opener versus Ryder, because I don't really see like a personal, and this is just kind of me personally, I'm not seeing any of these non-conference games as these big names, as these big things that you need to look for. But I think it's just that home opener against Ryder. It's just to start off the season. You know, they technically opened their new arena last season against Dayton, which a heck of a way to open that new arena for sure. But, you know, like Dan said, he's excited to see this with full fans too. And so just this is the first opportunity they have to play at home in the new arena in front of a whole bunch of fans. And I've been impressed with Danbro scheduling different teams in their non-conference play. He always schedules somebody new, somebody different that at least I maybe wasn't expecting to come in and play Duquesne, but he's bringing in teams, and he's bringing in like what Hofstra, I think is their second non-conference game. So that's a big one too, but he's bringing in Ryder. He's bringing in Weber State. He's bringing in some of these bigger non-conference games, and But I say look no further than the home opener, because that is going to be a chance to really show, maybe not show what Duquesne can do, but it'll give them a chance to, for these players to mesh. Because, I mean, you lost a bunch of real good players there, not least of which Tavian Dunn-Martin. Guess he wants some sunshine going out to Dunk City at Florida Gulf Coast. But you're bringing in some new guys, too. Trey Williams from Indiana State sticks out to me. I'm really excited to see him. But you're bringing in four guys from transfers, one from a D2 school. So this home opener is going to be a chance to really see, okay, what can these guys do, and what can Dambro do to mesh these guys? Dan alluded to it earlier. Bringing in transfers is always a sticky situation. You never know what the situation was in the previous school, and they're all coming from different systems. So it'll be the whole non-conference slate really is going to be a chance to see what Dambro can do. How can he fit these pieces together to come up with something cohesive? So I'm excited for the whole schedule, not least of which that home opener, to finally see what the heck we've got here on the court.
Yeah, I mean, the home opener is always probably the biggest game for any college basketball team. And, you know, that game against Hofstra, I'll definitely be watching. You know, as a Long Island guy myself, I always like to, you know, keep up with what all the New York area teams are doing. Another big trip on Duquesne's non-conference schedule for me, it seems like the Paradise Jam. That's going to be one of those early tournaments over in the Virgin Islands. And looking at some of the other schools that are there, Northeastern, Colorado, Brown, I feel like out of any A-10 school that can win a non-conference, you know, early season tournament, I wouldn't be surprised if Duquesne takes the Paradise Jam. I mean, how would you feel about that?
I mean, it's definitely, you know, lofty goals to kind of to put yourself in that tournament there, in that situation with those three teams. You know, it's clear Dambro is taking the go big or go home mentality to heart. And, you know, I'd say they have a great shot at kind of taking that. And if they can, I'm going to warn everyone, watch the heck out, because they're going to be coming through on fire through the whole rest of the season. Because a tournament win like that, that's going to put you on a high that you're not going to come down from very easily, no matter who you face after that. So if I were the rest of the A-10 conference, I'd be taking notice for that.
I would also suggest, I think we're burying the lead a little bit here too. I think, I mean, we talked earlier about Duquesne needing a signature win. I mean, heck, they've got that road game against DePaul on December 7th. And look, I know DePaul's not been as good as they've been in years past, but I mean, go on the road and win a game against DePaul. That's the type of win that could get you some recognition. I think that would turn some heads, especially on national television. I mean, Duquesne does not get on national television all that often.
Yeah.
And
that's the kind of statement when you need.
Exactly.
I mean, especially since DePaul's in the Big East, and, you know, this week, the top 25, the national top 25 rankings came out for the AP. And this is a really good year for the Big East. I think they had three or four schools in the top 25. And then St. John's was ranked like 30th. They got a couple points here and there. So any win against a Big East school is going to be great for the A-10. And so, Daniel, for George Washington, looking at their non-conference schedule, the obvious answer, I think, is Maryland, Big Ten school. The Terps kind of shook up a really good Big Ten last year. Are there any other, you know, standouts on GW's non-conference schedule?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. If you'd asked me 5, 6, 7 years ago, Maryland's a game that I would not only be ecstatic that they're on the schedule, I'd be getting tickets to go up to that and making arrangements to go. And I cannot justify the gas money up there this year, which is a terrible thing to say. It's hardly at distance, but I think that's the point I'm trying to make, is it feels like a waste of gas to go see them lose by 35 points at Xfinity Center and deal with the traffic. I mean, I'd love more than anything GW just go in and rock their stuff, like just completely beat the crap out of Maryland. That's not going to happen. So going back to reality real quick, I would say the one game, anytime that Charlotte appears on the schedule for GW, is always going to catch people's attention. It is GW Charlotte in 2006. For those who don't know, I did a a podcast episode with the College Basketball Stories talking about the 2006 GW season, and specifically the game against Charlotte, which is widely regarded as the greatest GW basketball game of all time. People rank it ahead of when they beat UMass when they were number one in the country. This was GW's year, basically the Dayton 2020 year for GW. They were undefeated in the Atlantic 10. They were ranked number six in the nation. Senior night, you know, they need a Carl, a Maurice Rice three in the corner to send it to overtime. And then Carl Elliott with a tap it at the horn to win the A-10 regular season title, finish an undefeated season. All that is to say, anytime that Charlotte appears on GW schedule, which has periodically every so often since they left the Atlantic 10 for Conference USA, that's one that I think every GW fan kind of looks and turns their head, especially that being a road game this year. I mean, how many road games is GW going to win? I mean, if you look at what they have, they got Maryland, they got UC San Diego and Cal State Fullerton. Not that either of those last two teams are very difficult necessarily, but that's a weird road trip for GW to be on. It doesn't scream success to me. And then they open conference play with, you know, some difficult road games and stuff. I mean, Charlotte might be their best chance to get a road win the whole season, frankly. I'd love to see them do it.
You're talking about their best chance to get a road win in non-conference and conference play.
Quite possibly. I mean, I don't want to bury this team before they are buried, and they do have, not to throw you under the bus, Sam, that last game of the regular season, the road game at Fordham. But other than, I mean, there's nothing on the schedule that screams, hey, that's a victory. I mean, look, let's look at that real quick. At St. Joe's, not a gimme. At Duquesne, no. VCU, good luck. At St. Louis, good luck. UMass is never a guarantee. GW's statistically or traditionally not done well up there. At Dayton, no. At George Mason, if George Mason's as good as they think they are, not a chance. And then that Forum's last one. I mean, do you just maybe they steal one or two along the way, but like there's nothing that jumps out off the page of me, like, oh yeah, I feel confident in that. Like, it just doesn't scream success for GW in that regard.
No, I mean, you're very right. I mean, I don't want to knock GW too hard this early in the season, but there's nothing really that I see that I'm like, oh yeah, that's winnable. What about this Naples Invitational? Wright State, Kent State, James Madison. How do you feel George Washington stacks up against these other schools?
It's hard to say because it's really not a great tournament they're in. If I'm going to be honest, I think it might be the worst of any of the A-10 schools. Just in terms of level competition, there's not a sexy name that really is like, oh yeah, I mean, I hope we get to play them. Like there was like, obviously no one's in the same league as VCU being in the Battle for Atlantis. I mean, obviously that's like, they're going to get a chance in their second game to possibly play to the defending national champion in Baylor. Like that is not the same sentence. But like, I'd like to think they could do well. They played an MTE 2 years ago, sorry, that had a similar type of field to it. And they did terrible. They lost every game. Like, sure, does GW have the ability to beat Wright State, Kent State, and James Madison? By God, I hope they do. I can't say it with certainty. I mean, look, I just want to make one thing abundantly clear. I don't want this to come across as me shit talking GW too much, ragging on and being like, oh man, they're not going to win a damn game this season. That's not what I want this to be. I want very clearly to state that there is nothing my heart internally wants more than to see GW succeed and compete for Atlantic 10 championships again. There's nothing my heart wants more. They're just not there right now. And I cannot lie to myself and say that they are what they are not. And hey, if this gives them bulletin board material and it ramps them up for the season, I hope it does, because I love this program with all of my being. I have gone to GW games since I was literally 2 months old. I just want them to succeed so badly. And I just don't think that's in the cards for them right now.
Of course. I mean, and again, you know, we're reporters, but we're also fans. So any criticism we say in this podcast, you know, comes with all the love we can give it. And with that, I think we'll end this kind of grim A-10 talk preview episode. But for everyone listening, don't worry, it'll get a lot better as we get into some a bit better teams going into the rest of this season. And so once again, I'm Sam Basil alongside Ed Major and Daniel Frank, and we'll see you next week. Thanks for checking in, guys.